Brad recognized the zombie in spite of its hitching, shambling walk and distorted face. It was as if someone had gripped Peter Jackson's head between his hands and squeezed. The man's eyes bulged from their sockets. The left had actually burst and lay on his cheek. His grin was even worse, a grotesque ear-to-ear rictus. They all stopped moving. Brad felt his fingers, laced together at the nape of Dave's neck, loosen, but Dave made no effort to pull away. The long hair in the blood-stained T-shirt was partially blocking Peter's way, and for a moment, Brad thought there was going to be a collision. At the last second, the hippie managed a single, shaky, backward step, making room. Peter turned his strangely distended head toward him. "Find my friend," he said to the hippie. His voice was faint and queasy, as if he had been gassed enough to fuck him up, but not quite enough to put him down. "Sit down with my friend." It went on up the path, kicking the leg of the outstretched animal, and Brad saw a weird thing. The animal, some sort of cat, was decaying with the speed of time-lapse photography, its pelt turning black and beginning to send up tendrils of nasty-smelling steam or smoke. They remained frozen, the hippie with his bloody shoulders hunched, the counter girl on one knee, Cammy standing in front of the girl and pointing the gun, Johnny with his hands up, as if he intended to try catching the bullet. Brad and Dave Reed caught in their wrestling pose as Peter drifted away from them down the path. The evening was utterly still, poised on a diminishing shaft of daylight. Even the coyotes had stilled, at least for the moment. Then Dave sensed the lack of strength in the hands holding his neck and tore out of Brad's grip. The boy showed no interest in Johnny, however. He charged at his mother instead. "You too," he screamed. "You killed him too." She turned toward him, shocked. "Why did you send us out here, Ma? Why?" He snatched the gun from her unresisting hand, held it up in front of his eyes for a moment, and then heaved it into the woods. Except they weren't woods, not anymore. They were now standing in a bristling, alien forest of cacti. Even the smell of the burning house had changed. It now smelled like burning mesquite or sagebrush. "Davy, I..." She fell silent, only staring at him. He stared back, just as white, just as drawn. It occurred to Brad that not long ago, the boy had been standing on his lawn, laughing and throwing a frisbee. Dave's face began to contort. His mouth drew down and shuddered open. Gleaming strands of spit stretched between his lips. He began to wail. His mother put her arms around him and began to rock him. "No, it's all right," she said. Her own eyes were like smooth, dark stones in a dry riverbed. "No, it's all right. No, honey, it's all right. Mom's here. And it's all right." Johnny stepped back onto the path. He looked briefly at the dead animal, which was now shimmering and oozing runnels of thick pink liquid. Then he looked at Cammy and her remaining son. "Cammy," he said, "Mrs. Reed, I did not shoot Jim. I swear I didn't. What happened was..." "Be still," she said, not looking at him. Dave was half a foot taller than his mother and had to outweigh her by 70 pounds, but she rocked him as easily now as she must have done when he was 8 months old and colicky. "I don't care what happened. Let's just go back. Do you want to go back, David?" Weeping, he nodded against her shoulder. She turned her terrible, dry eyes toward Brad. "Bring my other boy. We're not leaving him out here with that thing." She looked briefly at the fuming, stinking carcass of the mountain lion, then back to Brad. "Bring him. Do you understand?" "Yes, ma'am," Brad said. "I absolutely do." Tom Billingsley was standing at the kitchen door, peering out into the growing gloom toward his open back gate and trying to make sense of the sounds and voices he heard coming from beyond it. When a set of fingers tapped him on the shoulder, he almost had a heart attack. He struck out, but the red-headed woman in the blue shorts and sleeveless blouse had plenty of time to step back, and Tom's arthritis-bunched knuckles cold-cocked nothing but thin air. "Christ, woman!" he cried. "I'm sorry." Audrey's face, normally pretty, was haggard. There was a hand-shaped bruise on her left cheek, and her nose was swollen, the nostrils caked with dried blood. I was going to say something, but I thought that might scare you even worse.
"What happened to you, Aud?"
"Doesn't matter. Where are the others?"
"Some in the woods, some next door. Doesn't sound too good for the ones that are out. Lot of screaming."
He thought of something.
"Where's Gary?"
She pointed. Gary lay in the doorway between the kitchen and the living room. He had passed out while still holding his dead wife's hand. "We have to get with the others, Tom, before it starts again, before they come back."
"Do you know what's happening here, Aud?"
"I don't think anyone knows exactly, but I know some stuff, yes." She pressed the heels of her palms against her forehead and closed her eyes. She looked like a math student wrestling with some massive equation. Then she dropped her hands and looked at him again. "We better go next door. We should all be together." He lifted his chin toward the snoring Gary.
"What about him?"
"We couldn't lift him over David Carver's back fence. You'll be doing well to get over it yourself."
"I'll manage," he said, stung a little. "Don't you worry about me, Aud. I'll manage fine."
Peter reached the fork in the path and looked into the bone, white desert beyond it. Then he looked down and saw the man in the patched khaki pants pinned to the cactus.
"Hello, friend," he said.
He moved the bum shopping cart so he could sit down beside him. As he settled against the cactus spines, feeling them slide into his back, he heard a cry and a gunshot and an agonized howl, all from far away, not important. He put his hand on the dead bum's shoulder. Their grins were identical.
"Hello, friend,"
the erstwhile James Dickey scholar said again. He looked south. His remaining sight was almost gone, but there was enough left for him to see the perfectly round moon rising between the fangs of the black Crayola mountains, as silver as the back of an old-time pocket watch. Upon it was the smiling, one-eye-winked face of Mr. Moon, wearing a cowboy hat.
"Hello, friend," Peter said to it, and settled back further against the cactus.
He did not feel the exaggerated spines that punctured his lungs, or the first trickles of blood that seeped out of his grinning mouth.
He was with his friend, and they were looking at Mr. Cowpoke Moon, and everything was all right.
If the moon hadn't come up, Johnny thought, they would probably be in even deeper shit than they already were. They went up the path, now a gray streak about 2 feet wide winding through the shadows. Two by two, Cammie and her surviving son, then he and Brad, with the corpse of Jim Reed swinging between them, then Cynthia and the hippie Steve. The girl had picked up the 30-06, and when the coyote, a nightmare even more misbegotten than the mountain lion, came out of a cactus grove, it was the girl who settled its account. The moon was bringing out fantastic tangles of shadow everywhere, and for a moment, Johnny thought the coyote was one of them. Then Brad yelled,
"Hey, look out!"
And the girl fired almost at once. The recoil would have knocked her over like a bowling pin if the hippie hadn't grabbed her by the back of her pants. The coyote yowled and flipped over backward, its mismatched legs spasming. There was enough moonlight for Johnny to see that its paws ended in appendages that looked horribly like human fingers. Its mates raised their voices in howls of what might have been mourning or laughter. The thing began to decay at once, paw fingers turning black, rib cage collapsing,
eyes falling in like marbles. A moment or two later, those thick pink streams began to ooze out of its liquefying corpse. Johnny and Brad set Jim Reed's body gently down. Johnny reached for the .30-06 and poked the barrel at the coyote. He blinked with surprise as it slid past the darkening hide with no feeling of resistance at all. "It's like prodding cigarette smoke," he said, handing the gun back to Cynthia. "I don't think it's there at all. I don't think any of it's here, not really." Steve Ames stepped forward, took Johnny's hand, and guided it to the shoulder of his shirt. Johnny felt a line of ragged punctures made by the mountain lion's claws. Blood had soaked through the cotton enough for it to squelch under Johnny's fingers. "The thing that did this to me wasn't cigarette smoke," Steve said. Johnny started to reply, then was distracted by a strange rattling sound. It was coming from Dave Reed, who was standing rigidly beside his mother. It was his teeth.
"Come on," Brad said, then gently, "get moving, Cammy, okay?"
"Don't you tell me to get moving," she responded crossly. Her arm was around Dave's waist. She might as well have been hugging an iron bar, so far as Johnny could see. "Can't you see he's scared to death?" More howls drifted from the darkness.
"Yes, Cammy, I can," Brad said. "But you have to get moving. Else we'll have to go on and leave you here. We have to get inside. You know that, don't you?"
"See that you bring my other boy," she said sharply.
"We'll bring him," Brad said in a soothing voice.
He bent and took hold of Jim Reed's legs again.
"Won't we, John?"
"Yes," Johnny said, wondering what was going to be left of poor old Collie and Trajan come morning, assuming there would be a morning. Collie didn't have a mother present to stand up for him. They had made only a few steps when there was the gritty crunch of a footstep on the new surface of the ground, then a muffled cry of exasperated pain. Dave Reed shrieked as piercingly as a starlet in a horror movie. The sound made Johnny's balls pull up against his groin. From the corner of his eye, he saw the hippie grab hold of the rifle barrel when Cynthia brought it up. Steve pushed it back down again, murmuring for her to hold on, just hold on.
"Don't shoot,"
a voice called from the tangle of shadows up ahead. "Doc?" Johnny, who had come close to dropping his end of Jim Reed, now renewed his grip in spite of his aching arms and shoulders. "Doc, that you?"
"Yeah."
Two shapes appeared in the dark and moved cautiously toward them.
"I stuck hell out of myself on a goddamn cactus. What are cactuses doing in Ohio?"
"Excellent question," Johnny said. "Who's that with you?" "Audrey Weiler from across the street," a woman replied. "Can we get out of these woods, please?" Johnny suddenly knew that he could not carry his end of Jim Reed's body all the way back to the Carver house, let alone help Brad boost it over the fence. He looked around. "Steve, can you spell me on this for—" He broke off, remembering Steve's dance with the mountain lion.
"Oh, Christ!"
Tom Billingsley's voice made one syllable into two, then cracked on the second one like a teenager's.
"Which twin is that?"
"Jim," Johnny said. Then, as Tom stepped next to him, "You can't, Tom. You'll have a stroke or something." "I'll help," Audrey said, joining them. "Come on, let's go." Tuck dangled in the archway between the den and the living room, with Seth's dirty toes barely touching the carpet. Its eyes were bright and feverish. It used the boy's lungs in quick, hard gasps. The muscles of the boy's body seemed to thrum. The death of the cop had ripped Tuck out of its TV days, and it had snatched for the cop's essence quickly, instinctively, going all the way to the edge of its range, and then past, leaping for the prize and getting it. Energy had boomed into it like napalm. Another barrier had fallen, and it had found itself closer than ever to Seth Garin's unique center. Not there yet, but now so close. Its perceptions had also boomed. It saw the boy with the smoking pistol in his hand, understood what had happened, felt the boy's horror and guilt, sensed the potential. Without thinking, it leapt into Jim Reed's mind. It could not control him physically at this range, but all the fail-safe equipment guarding the boy's emotional armory had temporarily shorted out, leaving that part of him wide open. Tuck had only a second to get in and turn up all the dials, but a second had been enough. The boy might even have done it anyway. All Tuck had done, after all, was to amplify what had already been present. The energy released by his suicide had lit Tuck up like a flare and shot its borrowed nerves all the way into the red zone. Fresh, young energy flooded in, replacing the enormous amounts it had expended thus far. And now, it hung in the doorway, humming, totally loaded, ready to finish what it had started. Food first. It was ravenous. Tuck floated halfway across the living room, then stopped.
Aunt Audrey?
It called in Seth's voice. A sweet voice, perhaps because it was so little used.
Aunt Audrey, are you here?
No. It sensed she wasn't. Aunt Audrey was able to block off her mind sometimes, but never the steady pulse of that mind's existence, its there-ness. She could be with the others, but she had gone no farther, because Poplar Street was surrounded by Nevada desert now, a Nevada of the mind, the one Tuck had imagined into being. With Seth's help, it couldn't have done any of this without Seth. Tuck moved toward the kitchen again. Aunt Audrey's leaving was probably for the best. It would make Seth easier to control, make it less likely that he'd become a distraction at a crucial moment. Not that the little fellow could present much of a problem. He was powerful, but in many crucial ways helpless. At first it had been an arm wrestle between equally matched opponents. Except they weren't equally matched, not really. In the long run, raw strength is never a match for craft, and Tuck had had long millennia in which to hone its hooks and wiles. And now, little by little, it was gaining the upper hand, using Seth Garin's own extraordinary powers against him, like a master matched against a strong but stupid opponent.
Seth,
it asked as it drifted toward the refrigerator.
Where are you, pard?
For a moment, it actually thought Seth might be gone. Except that couldn't be. If Seth left this body, all the parasympathetic systems, heart, lungs, elimination, tissue building, cerebral wave function, would cease. Seth was the computer, and without him, the operator would die. Yet suicide was not an option for Seth Garin. Tuck could keep him from the act, just as it had driven Jim Reed to it. And it sensed Seth did not want to commit suicide. Part of Seth, in fact, did not even want to be free of Tuck, because Tuck had changed everything. Tuck had given him power wagons that weren't just toys. Tuck had given him movies that were real. Tuck had come out of the china pit with a pair of 7-league cowboy boots just the right size for a lonely little boy. Who would want such a magical friend to leave? Especially if you would once again be locked in the gulag of your own skull when your trusty trail mate was gone.
Seth?
Tuck asked again.
Where are you, you old cayuse, you?
And far back in the network of caves and tunnels and bolt holes the boy had constructed, Tuck caught a glimmer, a faint pulse that it recognized.
Thereness.
It was Seth, all right, hiding, confident that Tuck couldn't see, hear, or smell him. Nor could it, exactly, but the pulse was present, a kind of sonar blip. And if Tuck needed to, it could hunt Seth down and drag him out. Seth didn't know that. And if he was a good little trail hand, he would never have to find out. There was fresh chocolate milk on the top shelf. Tuck took the tall white Tupperware pitcher out with Seth's grimy hands, set it on the counter, then searched the meat drawer. There was hamburger, but it didn't know how to cook. Tuck had no objection to raw meat,
but eating hamburger that way made Seth's body ill. At least Aunt Audrey had said it was the raw meat that had made him sick, and Tuck didn't think she was lying. The last go-round had been the worst, vomiting and shitting all night. Tuck had vacated the premises until it was over, just checking in every now and then to make sure there was no funny stuff going on. It hated Seth's eliminatory functions, even when they were normal. There was bologna, though, and a few Kraft cheese slices, the yellow ones that it particularly liked. It used Seth's hands to put the food on the counter and used the extraordinary mind it and Seth shared to float a plastic McDonald's glass across from the cabinet where they were kept. While it made itself a sandwich, slapping meat and cheese onto white bread slathered with mustard, the plastic pitcher rose and filled the McDonald's glass, upon which was a fading picture of Charles Barkley going one-on-one with the Tasmanian devil. Tuck drank half the chocolate milk in four big gulps, belched, then emptied the glass. It poured a second glass with its mind while tearing into its sandwich, heedless of the mustard which splattered on Seth's dirty feet. It swallowed, bit, smacked, swallowed, belched. The roar in its gut began to subside. The thing about TV, especially when the regulators or MotoCops 2200 was on, was that Tuck got interested, fell into its powerful dreams, and forgot to feed Seth's body. Then, all at once, both of them would be so ravenous it could hardly think, let alone act or plan. It finished its second glass of chocolate milk, holding it over its mouth to catch the last few drops, then tossed the glass in the sink with the rest of the dirty dishes. Then it drifted back toward the kitchen door, a dirty boy balloon with the remains of a sandwich in one hand. Moonlight streamed through the living room windows. Beyond them, Poplar Street was gone. It had been replaced by the main street of Desperation, Nevada, as it had been in 1858, 2 years after the few remaining gold miners had realized the troublesome blue clay they were scraping out of their claims was, in fact, raw silver, and the declining town had been revitalized by disappointed wildcat miners from the California goldfields. Different land, same old ambition, to grub a quick fortune out of the sleeping ground. Tuck had known none of this. It was information Seth had gotten from a man named Alan Symes shortly before he had met Tuck. According to Symes, 1858 was the year the rattlesnake number one had caved in. Across the street, where the Jackson and Billingsley homes had been, were Lushan's Chinese Laundry and Worrell's Dry Goods. Where the Hobart House had been, the Owl County General Store now stood. And although Tuck could still smell smoke, the store wasn't showing so much as a single charred board. Tuck turned and saw one of the power wagons on the floor. It was poking out almost shyly from beside one end of the couch. Tuck floated it into the air and brought it across the room. It stopped before Seth's dark brown eyes, hanging in midair, its wheels turning slowly, while Tuck ate the rest of its sandwich. It was the justice wagon. Tuck sometimes wished it was little Joe Cartwright's justice wagon instead of Colonel Henry's. Then Sheriff Streeter from the regulators could move to Virginia City and drive the blue Freedom van instead of riding a horse. Streeter and Jeb Murdoch, who turn out to have been only wounded and not dead, would become friends. Friends with the Cartwrights, too. And then Lucas McCain and his son would move in from his spread in New Mexico and, well,
and I'd be Pa, it whispered. Boss of the Ponderosa. Biggest man in the Nevada Territory. Me.
Smiling, it sent the justice wagon around Seth Garin in two slow, beautiful circles. Then it swept the fantasies out of its head. They were lovely fantasies, though, perhaps even attainable fantasies, if it could gain enough essence from the remaining people across the street, the stuff that came out of them when they died.
It's getting to be time, it said. Roundup time.
It closed its eyes, using the circuits of Seth's memory to visualize the power wagons, especially the meat wagon, which would lead this assault. No Face driving, Countess Lily co-piloting,
and Jeb Murdoch in the gunner's turret, because Murdoch was the meanest. Eyes closed, fresh energy lighting up its mind, Tac began the job of powering up. It would take a little while, but now that things had gotten this far, it had time. Soon enough, the regulators would come.
"Get ready, folks,"
Tac whispered. Seth's fists were clenched at the end of its arms, clenched and shaking.
"You just get ready, because we're gonna wipe this town off the map."
Alan Symes worked for the Deep Earth Mining Corporation in the capacity of geological mining engineer for 26 years, from 1969 to late 1995. Shortly before Christmas of 1995, he retired and moved to Clearwater, Florida, where he died of a heart attack on September 19, 1996. The document which follows was found in his desk by his daughter. It was in a sealed envelope marked "Concern Strange Incident in China Pit" and "Read After My Death, Please." It is presented here exactly as it was found. The editors. October 27, 1995. To whom it may concern. I am writing this for three reasons. First, to clarify what happened 15 months ago in the summer of 1994. Second, I'm hoping to ease my conscience, which has been considerably stirred up again ever since the Weiler woman wrote me from Ohio, and I lied to her in my response. I don't know if a man can ease his conscience by writing things down in hopes they will be read later, but it's worth a try. Third, I can't get the way that little boy grinned out of my mind. I lied to Mrs. Weiler to protect the company and to protect my job. But most of all, because I could lie. July 24th, 1994 was a Sunday. The place was deserted, and I was the only one who saw them. I was just finishing some paperwork at Deep Earth's Nevada HQ, a double-wide trailer which is located about 2 miles off the main drag, Highway 50, on the outskirts of Desperation, a town known for its silver mining around the time of the Civil War. Our main mining operation these days is the China Pit, where we are leaching copper. Their Volvo station wagon pulled up out front and they got out. There were five. Dad, the Ohio woman's brother, he would have been. Mom, big brother, big sis, and little brother. LB looked to be four or so, although having read the Weiler woman's letter, I know now he was a little older, just small for his age. They dithered around their car for a minute, pointing to the embankment south of town. And then the little guy dragged his dad toward the office trailer. He pulled his dad right up the trailer steps and said, "Knock, Daddy. There's someone home. I know there is." Dad looked surprised as heck at that, although I didn't know why. I soon found out it wasn't what the little tyke was saying, but that he was saying anything at all. As soon as I opened the door, he ran in right past me. Right over to the wall he went, to the same bulletin board where Sally put up Mrs. Weiler's letter when it came in, marking it, "Can anyone help this lady?" in big red letters. He tapped the aerial photographs of the China Pit we kept tacked up, one after the other. "Here it is, Daddy," he said, tapping his way around those pictures. "Here it is. Here's the mine, the silver mine."
"Well," I said, kind of laughing, "it's copper, Sonny, but I guess that's close enough."
Mr. Guerin gave me a red-faced look and said, "I'm sorry, we didn't mean to barge in." Then he barged in himself and grabbed his little boy up. I was some amused, couldn't help but be. He carried the little tyke back out to the steps, where he must have thought they belonged. The boy didn't kick or have a tantrum, but his
His eyes never left the bulletin board. The rest of the family clustered around down below, staring up. The bigger kids were near bursting with excitement, and Mom looked pretty much in the same emotions. Father said they were from Toledo, then introduced himself, his wife, and the two big kids. "And this is Seth," he finished up. "Seth is a special child."
"The mine," the tyke says. "Seth want to see the silver mine. Hoss, Little Joe, Adam, Hop Sing."
"He loves Western movies and TV shows," Mr. Garin said. "And all I can figure is that the pit wall reminds him of something he must have seen on an episode of Bonanza. I thought maybe he even had seen it on an episode of Bonanza, though I don't recall telling Garin that. A lot of those old TV shows film scenic footage out this way, and the China Pit has been in existence since 57, so it's possible. Anyway," he said, "this is a major breakthrough for Seth. Except the word that really fits is miracle. It's like a bank of lights went on inside him. I don't know what did it, and I don't know how long it's going to last, but is there any way at all you could take us up to the mining operation, Mr. Symes? I know you're not supposed to, and I bet your insurance company would have a fit if they found out, but it would mean so much to Seth. It would mean so much to all of us. We're on kind of a tight budget, but I could give you $40 for your time." "I wouldn't do it for $400, I said. "It's the kind of thing a man does for free, or he doesn't do at all. Come on, we'll take one of the ATVs. Your older boy can drive it, if you don't have any objections." We had ourselves quite an afternoon, even before our little scare. The tyke jabbered all the way out to the pit, a mile a minute. A lot was gibberish, but not all. He kept talking about the characters on Bonanza and the Ponderosa and Outlaws and the Silver Mines. Some cartoon show was on his mind, too. Motor Cops, I think it was. He showed me an action figure from the show, a lady with red hair and a blaster that he could take out of her holster and stick in her hand. Also, he kept patting the ATV and calling it the Justice Wagon. Then Jack would kind of puff up behind the wheel and say, "Yeah, and I'm Colonel Henry. Warning, force corridor dead ahead." And they'd all laugh. I was excited enough so that one of the things he was saying didn't really hit home until later on. He kept talking about the old mine. Never crossed my mind to think he was talking about Rattlesnake Number One, because he couldn't know about it. Even the people in Desperation didn't know we'd uncovered it while blasting just the week before. When we got to the foot of the embankment, I swapped seats with Jack and drove us up the equipment road, which is all nicely graveled and wider than some interstates. We crossed the top and went down the far side. They all oohed and aahed, and I guess it is a little more than just a hole in the ground. The pit is almost 1,000 feet at its deepest and cuts through layers of rock that go back all the way to the Paleozoic era. Some layers of the porphyry are very beautiful, being crammed with sparkly purple and green crystals we call skarn garnets. From the top, the earth-moving equipment on the pit floor looks the size of toys. Mrs. Garin made a joke about how she didn't like heights and might have to throw up. But you know, it's not such a joke at that. Some people do throw up when they come over the edge and see the drop inside. Then the little girl, sorry, can't remember her name, might have been Louise, pointed over across, down by the pit floor, and said, "What's that hole with all the yellow tapes around it? It looks like a big black eye." "That's our find of the year," I said. "Something so big it's still a dead secret. I'll tell you, if you can keep it one a while longer. I might get in trouble with my company otherwise." They promised, and I thought telling them was safe enough, them being through travelers and all. Also, I thought the little boy would like to hear about it, him being so crazy about Bonanza and all. "That's the old Rattlesnake Number One," I said. "At least, that's what we think it is. We uncovered it while we were blasting. The front part of the rattlesnake caved in back in 1858. Jack Garin wanted to know what was inside. I said we didn't know. No one had been in there on account of the MSHA regulations. Mrs. Garin wanted to know if the company would be exploring it later, and I said, maybe, if we could get the right permits. I didn't tell them any lies, but I did skirt the truth a bit. We'd gotten up the keep-out tapes, like the MSHA says to do, all right, but that didn't mean the MSHA knew about our find. We uncovered it purely by accident. Shot off a blast pattern on the south face, and when the spill stopped rolling and the dust settled, there it was. But no one in the company was sure if it was the kind of accident we wanted to publicize. There would have been some powerful interest if news of it got out, that's for sure. According to the stories, 40 or 50 Chinese were sealed up inside when the mine caved in. And if so, they'd still be there, preserved like mummies in an Egyptian pyramid. The daughter said it looked spooky to her, and I said it did to me, too. She asked if I'd go in it on a dare, and I said no way. She asked if I was afraid of ghosts, and I said no, of cave-ins. It's amazing that any of the shaft was still up. They drove it straight into hornfels and crystal rhyolite, and that's pretty shaky stuff, even when you're not shooting off ANFO charges all over the place. I told her I wouldn't go in there even on a double dare, unless and until it was shored up with concrete and steel every 5 feet. Never knowing I'd be in there so deep I couldn't see the sun before the day was over. I took him to the field office, got him hard hats, then took him out and showed him all around, diggings, tailings, leach beds, sorters, and heavy equipment. Little Seth had pretty much quit talking then, but his eyes were as bright as the garnets we're always finding in the spoil rock. The older boy, Jack, wanted to see Mo, our biggest digger. There was a time in the early 70s when Mo was the biggest digger on planet Earth, and most kids are fascinated with her. Garen wanted to see her close up as much as young Jack did, and I assumed Seth would feel the same way. I was wrong about that, though. I showed them the ladder that goes up Mo's side to the operator's cab, which is almost 100 feet above the ground. Jack asked if they could go up, and I said no, that was too dangerous, but they could take a stroll on the treads if they wanted. Each tread is as wide as a city street, and each of the separate steel plates that make them up a yard across. Mr. Garen put Seth down, and they climbed up the ladder to Moe's treads. I climbed up behind them, hoping like mad nobody would fall. June Garen stood back a ways so she could take pictures of us, standing up there with our arms around each other. We were clowning and mugging for the camera and having the time of our lives until the little girl called out, "You come back, Seth! You shouldn't be way over there!" I couldn't see him because up where I was, all the rest of the digger was in the way, but I could see his mother and how scared she looked when she spotted him. "Seth!" she yelled. "You come back now!" And then dropped her camera on the ground and just ran. That was all I needed to see. I was back down the ladder in about 3 jumps. The little boy was already climbing the slope to the opening of the old mine, which was only about 20 feet up from the pit floor. I saw that and knew his mother wasn't ever going to catch him before he got inside. Wasn't anyone going to catch him before he got inside, if that's what he meant to do. I overtook Mrs. Garen just as Seth reached the mine entrance. He stopped there for a second, and I hoped maybe he wasn't going to go in. I thought there was a chance that if the dark didn't put him off, the smell of the place would. Kind of an old campfire smell, like ashes and burned coffee and scraps of old meat all mixed together. Then he did go in, and without so much as a look back at me yelling. I bypassed his mom, telling her to stay clear, that I'd go in and bring him out. I told her to tell her son and husband the same thing, but of course Garen didn't listen. I don't think I would have in his situation either. I climbed the slope and broke through the yellow tapes. The tyke was short enough so he'd been able to go right underneath. I could hear the faint roaring you almost always hear coming out of old mine shafts. Sounds like the wind or a far-off waterfall. I don't really know what it is, but I don't like it. It's a ghostly sound. That day, though, I heard another one I liked even less. A low, whispery squealing. I hadn't heard it any of the other times I'd been up to look into the shaft since it was uncovered, but I knew what it was right away. Hornfels and rhyolite rubbing together. That sound always made the miners clear out in the olden days, because it meant the works could come down at any time. I guess the Chinaman who worked the rattlesnake back in 1858 either didn't know what that sound meant or weren't allowed to heed it. The footing slipped on me just after I broke through the tapes, and I went down on one knee. I saw something lying there on the ground when I did. It was his little plastic action figure, the redhead with the blaster. It must have fallen out of the boy's pocket just before he went into the shaft, and seeing it there, laying in that broken-up rock, seemed like the worst kind of sign. I picked it up, stuck it in my pocket, and forgot all about it until later. I described it to my young nephew, and he said it's a Cassie Stiles figure from the motor cop show the little tyke kept talking about. I heard sliding rock and panting behind me, looked back and saw Garen coming up the slope. The other three were standing below, huddled together. The little girl was crying. "You go on back now," I said. "This shaft could come down any time. It's 130 damn years old, more." "I don't care if it's 1,000 years old," he said back, still coming. "That's my boy, and I'm going in after him." I wasn't about to stand there and argue with him. Sometimes all you can do is get moving and hope that God will hold up the roof. And that's what we did. I've been in some scary places during my years as a mining engineer, but the 10 minutes or so we spent in the old rattlesnake shaft was the scariest by far. The bore ran back and down at a pretty good angle, and we started to run out of daylight before we were more than 20 yards in. The smell of the place got stronger in a hurry, and that was strange, too. Sometimes old mines have a minerally smell, but mostly that's all. The ground underfoot was fallen rubble, and we had to step pretty smart just to keep from stubbing our toes and going face first. The supports and crossbeams were covered with Chinese characters, some carved in the wood, most just painted on in candle smoke. Mr. Garen was yelling for the boy, telling him to come back, that it wasn't safe. I thought of telling him that just the sound of his voice might be enough to bring down the hang wall, but I didn't. He wouldn't have been able to stop calling. All he could think of was the boy. I keep a little fold blade, a magnifying loop, and a pen light on my key ring. I got the pen light unhooked and shone it out ahead of us. We went on down the shaft, with the loose hornfells muttering all around us, and that soft roaring sound in our ears, and that smell up our noses. I felt it getting warmer almost right away, and the warmer it got, the fresher that campfire smell got, except by the end, it didn't smell like a campfire anymore. It smelled like something gone rotten, a carcass of some kind. Then we came on the start of the bones. There were bones littered everywhere on the shaft floor, cracked skulls and legs and hip bones and pelvises. The rib cages were the worst, everyone seeming to grin like the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland. When we stepped on them, they didn't even crunch, just puffed up like powder. The smell was stronger than ever, and I could feel the sweat rolling down my face. It was like being in a boiler room instead of a mine. And the walls! They didn't just put on their names or initials down where we were. They wrote all over them with their candle smoke. It was as if when the attic caved in and they found they were trapped in the shaft, they all decided to write their last wills and testaments on the support beams. I grabbed Garen's shoulder and said, "We've gone too far. He was standing off to one side and we missed him in the dark." "I don't think so," he said. "Why not?" I asked. "Because I still feel him up ahead," he said, then raised his voice. "Seth, please, honey, turn around and come back to us." What came back put the hackles up on my neck. Further on down that shaft, with its floor of crumbled scarn and skulls and bones, we could hear singing. Not words, just the little boy's voice going, "La la la," and "dum-dee-dee-dum-dee-dee-dum." Not much of a tune, but enough so I could recognize the Bonanza theme music. Garen looked at me, his eyes all white and wide in the dark, and asked if I still thought we'd come past him. Wasn't anything I could say to that, so we got moving again.